Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and joining us today is author, registered nurse, and licensed paramedic, Sherry Jones Mayo. Sherry has just published her fascinating book, Confessions of a Trauma Junkie, My Life as a Nurse Paramedic, which is out now on Loving Healing Press. Sherry Jones Mayo is a native of Michigan and is currently an emergency room nurse in Henderson, Nevada. She has combined her experience in emergency medicine and crisis intervention with a love for writing and has published her work in several military, civilian, medical, collegiate, and internet forums. Sherry's experience with emergency medicine stirred an interest in critical incident stress management in her 19 years with the United States Air Force Auxiliary Civil Air Patrol. She has advanced to the grade of Lieutenant Colonel. During her tenure as the National Director of Critical Incident Stress Management with Civil Air Patrol, Sherry was the key architect in developing CAP's national CISM program, taking it from concept to a full program supporting the emergency services work of the organization's 50,000-plus volunteers. Sherry is a member of and approved instructor for the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation. She is also a diplomat with the National Center for Crisis Management. Sherry is the mother of six, grandmother of one, and lives in Las Vegas with her husband, Gary. And you can find out more about Sherry Jones Mayo and her new book at sherryjonesmayo.com. So that said, welcome to the program, Sherry.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
So tell us exactly what is a trauma junkie.
It's kind of funny that I think there are people that are probably since birth have this inner calling to do this kind of work. And when we get into it, whether it's police, EMS, fire, we just kind of get addicted to it. It's like a drug for us. It becomes more of a lifestyle than a job. And we really get our juices flowing by when we face things that are impossible to face.
So is it kind of like an adrenaline junkie?
Yes, very much so.
A little bit. I was wondering if this kind of work really, if you believed it really was a calling, that it just, you know, there are certain people that are meant to do this type of work.
I do. I think there are people who get into it for other reasons, like it's a great paycheck, it makes me look like a hero. But the ones that are having a sense of urgency to do this, to get this done, kind of have an identification with the people who do this work from the time they're very young. I know for myself, when I was four, I picked up a dead dog, put it in my mother's bed, and tried to give it aspirin because I figured you can heal anything, and mothers know everything, and mom gave me aspirin, hence that should work. But I remember seeing Roy and Johnny, I think there were their names, in emergency many years ago, and it's like, oh, I want to do that so badly, but I don't think I'm smart enough. So I waited several years.
So you didn't go right into the field out of school?
No, I'm still not sure what I want to be when I grow up.
So funny. It's interesting that you had that inkling at such a young age. So when did it start to materialize?
I think I was about 33 when I finally got into emergency medicine. I moved to a small town, and I had worked for the Ann Arbor News as a display advertising person, and it just kind of left me with, what do I do now? And there was a volunteer fire department, volunteer EMS in that county, which is really weird because normally EMS is associated with fire, but we were not connected at all. We worked with the police department.
Mm.
So I met some people, found out they had the volunteer service. Anybody could join. They will train you. Hey, you know, maybe I can do this. So that's when I started.
Mm. And you, I mean, you've gone into all sorts of different areas with the with paramedic work, with the crisis management. So this has really branched out over the years into all sorts of different field parts of this field.
It has. When I was in the volunteer service, there were some calls that were just really horrible. It was farmland, and there were things that happened to children and things that happened to people, and we had at least a half-hour transport to any major hospital, so we did everything and we saw everything.
Mm.
And I saw people really traumatized by what they did, and there was no help for them. So that kind of spurred the interest to get into, okay, how do we help? And that got me into critical incident stress management. My son was a cadet in the CAP program at the very same time, of course. So I would sit outside the meeting hall and wait for him, and then I'm finding out these kids are doing great things and somebody should know. So I ended up doing public affairs for them. So it just kind of all gelled together.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. Well, when did the idea of writing this book, Confessions of a Trauma Junkie, when did that begin?
I think when I was in nursing school, they forced you against your will to write papers. And I found that writing was great therapy. I didn't need a counselor after that. I just wrote everything that came out of my heart and soul. And that book is pretty much it. It's my therapy, all of my confessions. So after, as I started to accumulate these, I thought, you know, maybe other people would like to know this too, because I'm not the only one. And I thought I was so alone in all of these things.
So did you have somebody that you could talk to? Is there support while you're going through this process and trying to understand your feelings?
Initially, no.
Really?
Yeah, so I did research, and the first time I ever talked to anybody was, on the website there's an excerpt from the first story in the book called Sweet Dreams Angel, which happened about 20 years ago. And when I couldn't get out of this circle of pain and emotional stress and just couldn't get it out of my head, couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, couldn't think, couldn't function, I called a friend of mine who had a degree in psychology, and he walked me through it. So Mark Gavalos, God bless you, he's still a good friend.
Mm.
And that led me to think that you have to have somebody to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So after him, it was kind of like I talked to my dog, talked to my 7-year-old daughter, and without all the big details. And you just kind of go and hug somebody, and sometimes that feels good too.
Mm. So what kind of stories can we really expect out of this book? Is it a lot of ER sort of blood and all of that, or is it really more of a personal experience?
It's more personal. There's not a lot of blood, guts, and gore in it. I start from, there is an accounting of when I was very young and I thought maybe this is what I need to do. There are some personal stories about when my own children were involved in some kind of stressful situations, but it covers EMS, ER, crisis management, military, Katrina. So I kind of go all over the board and try to give people an idea of what happens to people in emergency services and in the rescue fields who experience physical, mental, or emotional crisis.
Mm.
So usually all these people have single perspectives from all the things that I've done, and they don't understand what the other folks feel. And what I've tried to do is look at both sides of the gurney as patient, as caregiver, as family member, and try to let you see what's going on with all of us and how it all really gels together. We're not so different.
Do you think that most people in emergency management and emergency care like this, they really are having the same experiences and what's going on inside them?
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of people that don't care. They've got a wall up, or they think they don't care, but I think something just hasn't happened yet to make them care so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of us do care. And in the emergency room, it's funny when I get patients and they say, I'm in pain. You don't understand what pain is like. You know, they think for some reason because we're in the field, we don't have a life.
Right.
And oddly, I just had a major surgery on my neck, so I have this big nasty scar, which is working to my advantage now, because when I see patients, they start to go there and then they look at my neck and say, oh, you probably do understand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So unless you're marked with something, I guess they think we're superheroes.
Right. And you're just real people. So that's really interesting that patients can relate to you better if they see that you are like them.
Right. And I limp now, too. So.
And you limp.
On occasion when it's convenient. Oh, you have back pain. Oh, you understand.
Oh, that's so interesting. So was this, writing this book, somewhat of a cathartic experience for you?
Absolutely.
Mm.
I still cry sometimes. Some of the stories are tearjerkers. Some crack me up. But getting through it, it's like you hold these things inside you and they have to come out. A psychology teacher once told me when it comes to crisis and painful incidents, if you try to bottle them up and put them in a big old tin can and throw them to the bottom of the river and press on them, you can suppress it for a while, but it takes an awful lot of energy to keep that down. It takes an abnormal amount of energy to suppress those things. But eventually, that can's going to rust. Stuff's going to come to the surface, it's going to pop, and it's going to fly out with extreme force. And when that happens, that's not a good thing.
I imagine that the incidents of post-traumatic stress syndrome or disorder are really high in this field.
Oh, absolutely. I was talking to a fellow nurse recently who had a patient beat him up. And he expected to be a little upset about it because we've been hit by patients before, but it was so out of the blue for him and so unexpected, and he thought he was in a safe place. So his guards were down. And he ended up with PTSD, ended up having therapy for quite a while, and still can't talk about it. So there is that possibility for anyone in any incident, whether it's perceived or real, to end up with PTSD and a crisis response.
Now, how do you think you manage? I mean, you've been in this field for so long, not to end up with PTSD.
Part of being the daughter of an Italian mama and a Marine dad, I was always told there's a way, find a way. So when things went bad, when feelings were bad, instead of wallowing in it, it was always a desire to find the way out.
Mm.
So I just kept looking for the door.
So is this book really primarily for just the general population, or did you write it with the intent that emergency workers in the field would be reading it?
Initially, I just wanted to write it because I had to write it. I really didn't know who my audience was going to be. When the people who were reviewing the book for endorsements read it, their endorsements came out as, yes, everybody in emergency medicine should read this. Yes, everybody in mental health should read this because it's a preparation to deal with folks in a way you had not anticipated. It's not in other books, not in your college curriculum. But as people are reading it, I'm finding more and more that they are interested because they've had somebody in EMS, somebody in an ambulance, somebody in as a patient, somebody in the emergency room, or they themselves have gone through this. So it's just like the people who are watching these shows on television now. They watch ER, they watch House, they watch all these other programs because they really want to see what's going on. Reality is a big thing, and this book is 100% real.
Right, right. Well, I was going to ask you about your thoughts on all of these TV shows that are out now and why the population seems to be so fascinated. I mean, like you say, ER, House, these are some of the highest-rated shows on television right now.
There has always been an interest in medical shows. They used to give you the hero aspect, but I think more and more they're giving you some real things, and people like to see the real things. Trauma, Life in the ER was filmed somewhat in my hospital. I know the paramedics that were there, and the things that you see are not ever what you expected, and I think people are just fascinated, just like when you pass an accident and you're rubbernecking.
Yeah, you're right.
Look. You have this inner desire to see what's really happening, kind of like me as a child. Oh, my gosh. When I was in sixth grade, I had to see what was going on inside of animals for some reason because you can't cut people apart.
Sure, right.
So my mother, God bless her, took me to a meatpacking place. We got a pig's head and some body parts.
Oh.
And my sixth grade teacher, Mr. White, had opened up the divider between two classrooms, and they were all looking at me in the center, and I'm just chopping away at all these parts and making them out and showing everybody.
At grade six?
In grade six.
Oh.
I had no idea that that was abnormal. I thought everybody wanted to know what was going on. So it's kind of the same thing. I think there's an inner desire of a lot of people to know what's going on in places they can't see.
Mm-hmm. And there is a real fear of hospitals and, being hurt. And, I mean, that's that really touches on our basic survival mechanisms. So I imagine that, you know, having some idea of what's going on there kind of, I don't know, just makes us not as fearful about the situation.
I hope so. And there is a lot of fear, and some of it's justified. There are people out there who watch the news who don't know what they're doing, who make mistakes. The girl who was a drug addict and had hepatitis and was stealing medicine from patients' vials with the same needle she injected herself with. Those are the crazy things that happen. And I don't talk about this here because I don't have any experience with that. But that certainly does raise people's fear factor. So when they come in and someone sounds like they know what they're doing, they're doing the appropriate things, they're giving good education, and nursing is all about education. The doctor says, this is what we're going to do, walks out and comes in at the end, maybe, then I think it does calm them a bit. Mm. Information is power.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I understand that there was some situation that you had on a airline flight that there was a passenger, you had to perform emergency medicine on a flight.
That was so much fun.
Tell us about it.
I used to work in Detroit and Las Vegas simultaneously. I couldn't give up my trauma center. I was too much of a junkie to give it up completely and come to this calmer region. I was used to having 3 or 4 gunshots a day and 3 or 4 codes a day and having a patient load of sometimes 17 and you're going nuts. But it was impossible, and it was fun to do the impossible. So So on one of my trips back from Las Vegas to Detroit, somebody rang the buzzer, are there any medical personnel on board? And your first thought is not, oh, cool, that's me. It's O-S-H-I-T.
Right.
Because you don't know what the protocols are. You don't know what equipment they have. You don't know anything. So I waited a minute. Nobody rang your buzzer. So I did. Silly me. And they said, could you come with us? Another bad sign. No information.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got to the front of the first class area where they normally distribute food, sorry, first class passengers, you're out of luck for a while, there was a woman in some distress. So I took care of her. I assessed her, found out we needed to do something. So we contacted the Mayo Clinic, got orders. And it was kind of fun. It was like being on the ambulance again. She was on the floor. I was starting IVs. I was getting medications out and giving them. And the poor flight attendant was writing everything down the best she could and cleaning up my mess. But it was a hoot.
Mm-hmm.
The woman got better. So I won. There's this enemy we always fight in medicine. It's death. It's illness. It's injury. It's the horrible things that we don't want to think about. And we get to fight against them, and sometimes we win. So at the end of her care, when I turned her over, I guess the paramedic said something really nice to the flight attendant about, is she a doctor or something? No, I'm just a nurse. Mm-hmm. And any nurse with my training could have done the same thing. Any paramedic with my training could have done the same thing. I just happened to be there at that time.
Yeah.
So when I went back to my seat, those silly people, I ended up getting a standing ovation and two bottles of wine.
Oh, my God.
Northwest did not give me any points. Well, they gave me points, I think, eventually. But it would have been nice to get a free ticket out of it. Didn't get that. But I got the joy and the experience of doing that again.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it.
Oh, you were really meant for this kind of work. I mean, don't you get bored working in a hospital and not being at the front on the front lines?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Being a medic was the best job I ever did. I unfortunately got old.
Yeah. So you couldn't do it anymore?
No, I just, 20 years in emergency medicine, I've got a bad back, bad neck. Matter of fact, I had a procedure yesterday on my lower back, and I'm trying to avoid surgery. But that's what happens to us because we get too many patients. And this is a sad thing. There are patients who are heavy, and, you know, I'm sorry you're heavy, but they have the ability to walk, and they won't. They have the ability to sit up in a cart, and they won't.
Mm.
So they expect you to do it for them. And eventually you get a injury.
Yeah. You physically, you just can't handle it.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about the, you know, that part of you that is a healer, that does want to give and help people, and where the line is on taking care of yourself and how that line can get crossed.
We put ourselves last.
Mm-hmm.
People who are empaths, people who are true healers, always put themselves last. They sometimes make poor decisions, like when someone's falling, they're too heavy, you know they're going to fall, you know they're going to hurt you if you grab them, but you grab them anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in many instances, we will cross the line, unfortunately. But hopefully, if there is greater understanding within the field, if we can educate our own people better, then when that happens and when the line is crossed and when you're traumatized or injured by it, hopefully somebody's going to be there to talk to you. And it's not just a chaplain that we need more.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that is talked about when in the education process? Is this something that colleagues talk about?
Very briefly.
Really?
There are folks out there that still say it's a bunch of nonsense. If you can't handle it, you shouldn't be in this field. Buck up, take it. You're okay. You're not okay. I have seen hundreds and thousands of people when I was doing crisis management teaching, and I went about once a month somewhere in the country and taught classes. And then I did interventions. And I see a lot of people who get stuck, who have that deer in the headlights, 1,000 yards there, and they're stuck in something, and it's so easy to pull them back out. But when you approach some EMS services or police services, then I've actually called a police sergeant and told him his guy is freaking here in my ER, you need to do something now. Because the poor man had just handled newbie, green, 18-month-old came to the ER, burnt to a crisp, and it was more than he could handle.
Mm-mm-mm.
Or the police officers who bring in one of their own whose frontal plate of his head, whose forehead is kind of poking through the back of his head now, and he's dying.
Mm-mm.
There's just things that are too much to handle, but
yeah.
These folks don't want to admit it. They don't want to, and this is the big one, spend the money. I approached the ER where I'm working now and said, I will teach your people. I will teach them how to set up a team. I can do all that. I know how. I've done it. Nope, costs too much.
Mm.
So if they have mental health on hand, and if they have a chaplain, they think that that's enough, and it isn't.
And it isn't. It really isn't.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Sherry Jones Mayo. She is the author of Confessions of a Trauma Junkie, which is out on Loving Healing Press. And you can find out more about this book and Sherry through her website, SherryJonesMayo.com. So at this point, how could the system really better prepare the young people coming up in this field and then in other emergency services, you know, the police force, that sort of thing? How can they be better prepared for these kinds of situations?
I got an email this morning from a guy who's been doing this far longer than I have. He was a medic when it was load and go, when you had hearses that you would put people in the back of, jump in the front, and get going like Mother Jugs and Speed. But he said people need to read books like this because they have such an enormously erroneous image of what we do. So if in the training people would touch more on it, if nurses would get ride time in ambulances as part of their training, if the education component would include more of this, if people would use more peer support, and peer support is the key.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm sitting down, and I remember doing this when I was a medic, and you have an incident and some mental health person comes in, God bless them, they know what they're doing, but if they walk in and Susie social worker comes in with her little clicky heels, long skirt, sweater, jewelry, flipping her hair back and says, "Hi, I'm here to help you," it's not going to help us.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a paramedic standing next to her that has been on the road with us, has stepped on the glass and brain matter and has been through all these things, and he says, "Hey, she's okay, she's with me," then we might talk. So the peer component, having someone with you that understands what you've been through, those people you can talk to, those people you can vent to, those people you can listen to and take the information and the education they're giving you on how to get through this when it happens or if it happens.
That is incredible, incredible work. So what are some of the ways that that are positive ways that people can deal with the weight of this job of a trauma care practitioner?
Don't keep it inside.
Mm-hmm.
Talk.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, take a deep breath. Number two, go home and talk to somebody that you feel you can share with. My husband doesn't understand emergency medicine. He's got an MBA from Duke. It's not his field. He's a sustainable strategist. However, I can call him from the ER when I have a bad call, and I did from Detroit many times. I run in the bathroom, which is the only place you can hide, pick up the phone and say, "Gary, just talk to me."
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that was the key, to just say anything so I could hear his voice and I could get centered back to ground zero.
Just grounds you.
Yep.
Anything that will ground you. I imagine if you don't catch yourself, you can really get far out there quickly.
Right, but don't keep it inside. And yes, recognizing that that's starting. If you know these things are possible, then when it starts to happen, you can take a deep breath and go, "Okay, this is what they were talking about. Now what do I do?"
Mm-hmm.
And you talk it out, and you keep talking. Have you ever seen somebody who's been on their way to work on the expressway, almost got clipped in their brand new car, and they come into work, and they're absolutely breathless, and they will tell their story to one person and the next and the next and the next. And by the end of the day, you've heard it 12 times.
Right.
But they're going to tell it and tell it and tell it and tell it until they get better, because
yeah,
their mind's got to work out the possible tragedy, because they saw themselves getting hit. They saw all the things that could have happened had they been hit, even if they weren't.
That's a really, really good point to make. You know, the brain doesn't really decipher what really happened and what the thoughts are, where your thoughts go with that.
Exactly. Trauma is also anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
If someone holds a gun to your head, they might as well have shot you.
Isn't that interesting? Now, I know you are getting into the health psychology field. So is this an area that you're talking about now that you're really going to be pursuing in the future?
Yes, I'm finishing my bachelor's. Where I lived up in Michigan, there was no university within 135 miles. So I drove 50 miles each way to the local college, community college, got 4 degrees, got called into the dean's office and said, okay, you got a 4 point. You've finished everything we've got. Can you please move on? So that was kind of my hint, but I didn't have time. I was working with the national CISM team for 10 years. So the year I gave that up, I went back to school full-time, wrote the book, got married, did all the things I've been waiting to do but didn't make time for myself to do. So now I'm finishing the bachelor's and then going into hopefully health psychology, which is a relatively new field. And it does combine the two sides that never seem to want to meet. The body is one person. We have a mind and we have a body and we have things that go wrong and they affect each other and they influence each other. So we need to have people that can put those two components together, two professionals who will work together for the good of the patient and see what's going on both sides to make the patient heal.
And you kind of alluded to this in your preface in Confessions, the whole idea of the mind-body connection.
Right. How could we separate those things?
Right. Exactly.
Let me put my brain on the table here while you deal with my broken ankle.
Yeah. You know, another thing that you talk about in your preface, in your book, is that you are emphatically not the same person you were before getting involved in medicine. So tell us a little bit how you changed.
It's funny because people look at me now at 53 and say, how did you get so smart? Well, I wasn't at 23. I was pretty dumb, and I made a lot of silly errors and walked through a lot of bad places. But all these experiences that we have as human beings, we can take them and look at them and say, okay, how can I make this make me better, make me stronger, make me smarter? Or do I set it aside and go, oh, my God, I've just been raped. I'm going to live in it forever, which is not to discount that. I bring that up because I have been, and I know what it feels like, and I know what the trauma is. So I know that I can take that situation and learn from it and grow from it and be more empathic to my patients about it, or I can just shut it out. And shutting things out doesn't work, and wallowing in pain doesn't work. So as you take all of these steps and these experiences and bring them in and reframe them, look at the lady who lost a daughter to a drunk driver. My goodness, she formed Mothers Against Drunk Driving. She did phenomenal things from something that is the most painful thing I think anybody can ever experience. She lost her child. So I think all of us, and I hopefully have taken enough of these things to learn a little bit more. I'm still growing. I'm still learning.
Well, and you probably will be for all of your days. I mean, it sounds like that is just how you embrace life. And so not only are you a healer, but you're a teacher as well.
And that's fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have a passion about something in your heart, and you go out and you get to tell other people. There's a moment when they get it, and you see that, and it's like, oh, there's that adrenaline all over again.
And it's just a little different. Well, tell us a little about how you got involved with critical incident stress management and the whole experience you had with Hurricane Katrina.
The crisis management thing went back to that Sweet Dreams Angel story when I had the incident that made me freak out. And I tried to bring the program to my EMS folks, and they weren't interested because they were of the thinking, being police officers and EMS, that if you can't handle it, go away. Actually, if something bad happened, we went to the police chief's house and had pie. That didn't work real well. That was not stress management. And a lot of people go to the bar and drink too much.
There you go. Yes.
A friend of mine, Don Brown, Chaplain Don Brown, says, you don't drown your sorrows. You only teach them to swim. So that prompted it. That started a lot of research. So I brought the program to Civil Air Patrol. And when Katrina happened, I had had time already to have a full CISM team in place. So as soon as they hit Cat 4 winds, we knew that we might go out. We started preparing, and then we went to Katrina. And it was an awesome experience because the people who were there were traumatized before they got there. Look at all the media. Look at all the repetition of the pictures and the loss and the enormous amount of death. So when we went, we got to talk to folks and help them reframe their experience and see that they did help. They did make a positive impact on these people. The experience there was incredible by our folks. They were going door to door. And for all the negative things you hear about Katrina and what happened down south, we went to Jackson, Mississippi and three forward operating bases. And what our people found were that they would walk up to the door in their full military gear and the folks would offer them water. They would offer them their last meal. They had one chicken to cook. They said, do you want to stay and eat with us?
Wow.
So it was just tremendous. They would go to party stores and get gas and a couple of snacks, and then people would say, no, you're here to help us. You're not paying. So when we talked to these folks as they were leaving off base and going back home, we had the opportunity to give them a segue if you just leave a place like that and go straight home without anybody talking to you, it's really, really traumatic because you've left this disaster area with all this loss and all this death. You can smell the death.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back home where people are just living their normal lives, where they all have plenty of drinking water, where their flowers are pretty and clean, their lawns are all mowed, nothing is lacking, and it's jarring. So being able to go there and talk to the folks and tell them what they contributed, making them feel good about what they did instead of the bad feelings they had about, we didn't get here soon enough, we couldn't do enough, we reframed it, and we gave them a positive outlook. So they went home feeling very good about themselves and very willing to share their experiences in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a great experience.
Absolutely. Was there anything that you learned from being in that experience, in the moment, that you applied in the way of changing up some of the way that you were, I don't know, that you would set up the whole stress management protocol?
Oh, absolutely. We found in our processes that we didn't have the appropriate notification program in place, so we had to go back and change that, and we had to work with all of our people. We learn tons of things whenever we do something for the first time. So
mm-hmm.
we contacted the Critical Incident Stress Foundation, told them what we learned. We got within our own ranks and said, we need to be first notified. You need to have this. We have a regulation in place that needs to be followed for people to go out there, because initially the wrong people went, identified themselves as part of our team, which they weren't, which delayed our team getting there.
Mm.
So there are just so many protocols, especially in the military, because thank God for the after-action report. You do all of your lessons learned, all of your best things that you have to offer and the things that you want to change from there on. So it's an incredible learning experience. And if I had been home and just saying, you go, I would not have learned anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it was wonderful to be there, boots on the ground, and experience it all. And to this day, I really appreciate life a lot more. Those people gave up so much, and they experienced so much.
Mm, wow. Isn't that incredible? So, getting back to your book, I want to talk a little bit about the introduction, because I know that this is a really important part of the book for you, and you hope that readers don't skip over it. So I'd like to have you just talk briefly to that.
There's a lot of, I do this too. When you read a book, you skip past the introduction and you don't want to go there because it's really not important to you. But what I've put in there is kind of a lot of what's important to me before you read it, and that's where my heart is. That's where I get to acknowledge folks who made the book and my survival possible. If it weren't for certain people, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have done any of this. I would have been stuck in that same hole that people get into and can't get out. But there's a note in there about anyone who's ever worked the road or is still working the road, especially police officers, who are my heroes. I love them. I pray for them. Even if I've never met them, they're part of my family. They put themselves and their lives on the line every single day. They do amazing work. And I've got a friend named Jeff Baer, who I met in Pennsylvania, who was a police officer, did crisis management, and now he's finishing his master's degree in counseling, which is an awesome place for a police officer to go. But he gave me a quote once that just really hit my heart about police officers. He said, policemen are the only warriors in the battlefield who run toward the sounds of the guns. The others run to retreat. They are the only ones who can save a life, take a life, or bring a life into the world.
Mm.
So all of us in emergency services of any kind laugh, cry, do silly things. We're totally irreverent when nobody's looking. But then we run home and we hug the people we love and we try to forget all the bad stuff, and then we come back and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that I'd like people to know, especially my coworkers, is if you get to the point where you don't have the passion or compassion that you used to do, go do something else. Because otherwise you cannot keep your sanity intact. You become a different person, a very bitter person.
That's a really good point. That's a very good point. And is that burnout then at that stage?
Yes, ma'am, that is burnout.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing that we just haven't even really focused on yet is the whole fact that this book and a lot of your message is about humor and finding the humor in you know, little situations. So talk to us a little bit about how that really is a huge survival mechanism for this type of work.
Oh, absolutely. If we don't laugh, we're going to cry. And the gallows humor that emergency workers have is not appreciated by folks, especially when they're in the midst of some kind of a trauma. But we crack up, and it just, I mean, you know, laughter is a good medicine. It gets the right adrenaline things going.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at things in a different way. When we go into the break room, the stories we tell are incredible. And this book does tell a few of those items. I'd like to go into a lot more, but even in triage, when you say something as simple to a patient as, I'm going to take your vital signs, and they freak out and say, vital signs? I got vital signs? Well, yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, right.
Or the guy who comes up and says he dropped something on his foot, and then he's waiting too long, waiting. And then somewhere on the news he heard that if you go to the front of the line and say, I'm having chest pain, they'll let you in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't always work, especially in a Detroit trauma center where there's an 8-hour wait and you really have to take the most sick patients first.
Mm-hmm.
So we will tell him when he comes back and says, okay, I'm having chest pain. It's like, okay, 22 years old, you dropped something on your foot, you're working on it just fine, your vitals were perfect, you have no medical history, you have no family history, you don't even smoke. So I don't think you're at a high-risk stratification for having a heart attack. I'm sorry about the wait. Please have a seat. And they look at you and say, well, what if I drop dead?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, sir, then you're the first in line.
Yeah.
And then we bite our tongues because we're not so sure that was the most appropriate thing to say. But that's how it is.
That's
then we go in the back and wait. There are things in the book about names. Oh, my gosh, the people that name their children the same thing and pronounce it differently, same spelling, you don't think those kids are going to get confused?
Yeah, right.
Or they come up with about 3 pages of listings of children and they say, which one are you? And they point to the thing and the kid's got to identify themselves because the parents don't know who they are. You betcha we go in the back room and say, you wouldn't believe what I just saw.
Oh, God. That is so funny. Human behavior is so funny.
Mm-hmm.
Really funny. Well, and I hear, too, that you are a master water pistol maker or something like that.
The best thing I could ever teach any resident. And when I was in Detroit, we got new residents every year, and they'd say, teach me everything you know. I want to know about IVs because you're really good at it. And the ones that I liked, I'd say, okay, I'm going to teach you the most important thing I've ever learned. So they get all excited, and I'll pull them aside, and I take out like a 30cc syringe and a 22-gauge catheter, soft tip, fill the syringe up, and then show them how to make a water pistol because you can flip around, shoot somebody about 40 feet away, turn back around. They have no idea where it came from. I have so many residents that have done that and gone back and used it, and then they come back all giggling and going, it worked. It was so much fun.
That is so funny.
Again, you can't do that in the day shift because all the shirts and skirts are there, but on midnights, oh, we had a ball.
Yeah, that's when all the fun happens.
Mm-hmm.
So funny. Well, you are such an inspiration, and I know that clearly you inspired your daughter because she's now in the field of emergency med.
That silly girl.
Yeah.
7 years old and poring over my medic books and just looking at all the pictures. I couldn't stop her. She even found things on the internet that were actual pictures of what happens to people and what happens to bodies in trauma. And it's like, look, Mom, this is really cool. And I have to say, yeah, that is cool. And as a kind of aside, we realize that these are people in pain and people who ask us about what we do and all the gory things they see and they want to see the stories. Hey, folks, that's somebody's family. You know, have a little respect.
Mm.
But my daughter, the minute she got out of high school, went right into my emergency room. And we got to work together for several years, which was great. But she's been doing it for 9 years now. She does not want to get into nursing. She doesn't want to work there anymore. She wants a desk or a teaching job, an administration job. She's burned out. She started too young.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was just in her. I mean, some people, they just have this innate ability, and she had it because she would correct nurses sometimes when they were about to do things wrong because she just knew, and I don't know how you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the computer geeks, like my son at 6 years old that sat down at a computer and started programming. How do you know?
Oh, my gosh.
I don't get that.
It's born with it.
Yep.
Born with it. Isn't that interesting? So is it her or is it you on the front cover of your book?
Neither.
Okay.
But I love that girl's sardonic smile, and she's really a representation of all that's going on in here because no matter how old we get, I'm still that four-year-old. I'm still that little girl that's trying to understand, that's trying to heal people, that's trying to do the impossible. And that's why I fell in love with that girl's photo because she is me. If you could look beyond this 53-year-old, that's what you would see.
That's fantastic. Sherry, it's been so great talking with you. You are just so full of inspiration and information, and I just really thank you for taking your time today. This has been really interesting. So your website is sherryjonesmayo.com.
Correct.
Correct. And book can be bought through your website. I know you're starting a blog. There's all sorts of information for listeners to find out through your site.
Right. It's SHERRYJONESMAYO. People want to spell Sherry wrong. Just like the wine.
Oh,
No. If you order from my website, there's a comment section. If you want an autographed copy, I'd be more than happy to do that. Just write it in the comments part.
Okay, wonderful. And then also your book is available through online booksellers and ordered through local bookstores. Well, great. So we talked a little bit about what's next for you in terms of schooling. Do you plan on writing any more books?
I'd love to. The first one, the publisher wanted me to focus strictly on my own stories, which I balked at because that's painful, but I did it anyway. I'd like to write something that involves other people's stories as well and with a little information about them and how they got to where they are, because I think there are so many fantastic stories out there to be told.
Clearly, and we need to hear them.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sherry. It has been great. Our time is coming to an end. Was there any brief final thoughts you wanted to share with listeners today?
I just really want to thank you for this opportunity. And regarding the book, it was not easy to write, but I think it needed to be told. And I hope it helps emergency medicine folks, other folks out on the street. I hope it makes people laugh, and I hope it brings us all a little closer together.
Oh, wonderful. You take care. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, listeners, that's been Sherry Jones Mayo. Her new book, Confessions of a Trauma Junkie, My Life as a Nurse Paramedic, is out now on Loving Healing Press. And you can find it through Sherry's website, sherryjonesmayo.com, also through online booksellers, and maybe check out your local bookstore. If they don't have it, they can certainly order it. Support your local business. So I want to thank you once again for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.